WLFP Braddock.
Good morning, diners and travelers of the world. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And it certainly ought to be a very interesting morning because we're starting it by tasting beer.
Yeah, we're doing one of my favorite things for any time of the day or night, sitting around a table with beer in front of us. But there's a reason for that, because you know that On the Menu tortures themselves on your behalf, and we experiment with things that no one in their right mind would do except us. So today we decided we would have a beer tasting. And the concept is that it's not just to taste the beer, it's to figure out how beer goes with food and how different kinds of beer go with different foods.
Now, we have on the line, I might say, Julia Hertz of the Brewers Association, which she'll explain a little bit later. And in the studio, we have Colin Peterman, who is, in fact, a brewer and are you a brewmeister? Is that correct?
Yeah, brewer or brewmaster is
with
fine.
With Rock Bottom, which he has some interesting things to tell us about that. But let me turn it over to Peter, who's the beer
Let's do the most important thing first. The most important thing first is to drink beer and then figure out what to eat with it. So Colin brought three or four different kinds. And he selected one for us to start with, so... go for it, Colin. Tell us what we're going to taste and then go from there.
Okay. The first beer that I brought with me today is a pretty much a non-traditional German lager. It is what I've called Sommerbock, and it's a strong lager. It comes in at about 7.5%, but it's very light-bodied and pretty easy to drink with a subtle sweetness in the finish. It's generally, like I said, a lot lighter than your average Bock beer, which tend to be very full-bodied.
Yeah, Bock's typically a fall and winter beer.
Correct.
So you've adapted this a little bit.
I have. It's kind of the fun of being an American brewer. We're not bound by any old rules. We kind of get to do what we want.
Now, what's your thinking here in terms of, you said the style? Why did you make it? Because you like Bock, but you wanted to do something in the summertime?
I do. I spent quite a bit of my formative training as a brewer in a traditional German brewery in Baltimore, Maryland. And I got to learn a lot about the styles and the German way of making beer. And I guess you could say it's my favorite genre of beer. Or country of origin. So I spend a lot of time trying to make good German beers in an American style.
What do you think about that, Julia? That's an interesting idea, huh?
This is absolutely what our lovely American brewers are out there doing today, and particularly the craft brewers. So I applaud Colin and his outlandishly wonderful artistic ways.
I'm not even a beer drinker, and this is good.
So what would we pair this with?
Well, I think that this beer, with its sweetness, plays well with lots of different kinds of foods. I think it would go wonderful with a good chicken dish. I think it would also be a nice beer with, like, salads and fruits, especially fresh fruits for the summertime, and even desserts because of the little bit of lingering sweetness that goes with the beer.
Do you ever mix beer and wine in a single meal?
I don't see any reason why not to.
Huh.
There you go. But the concept of pairing beer, doing beer dinners where it's beer with everything, is fairly new. And we'll ask Julia to tell us more about how new it is just a little bit later. So, Julia, what do you think?
Well, I am the handicapped, underprivileged right now of not tasting along with your listeners.
Oh, you've never had this.
But essentially, I mean, I've never had that combination of styles, and then that's what's so great. But what Colin mentioned for food pairings is probably where I would have taken it. It sounds like something like that, because of a little bit of the sweetness, would go with good lighter foods like chicken or salads or salmon, maybe some bratwurst. And the light.
I could use some of that right now.
Yeah,
that would
there you go.
Really well with it.
Wouldn't it? Beer and bratwurst for breakfast. That's what everybody does. it's sort of like the Australian version of what's called a hero's breakfast. which is a beer and a cigarette, frowned upon these days, I guess. But that's certainly what they used to call it. And there, in certain parts of town, like where the vegetable and the meat and fish markets were, the pubs used to open at 4 o'clock in the morning, and it was called a mushroom session. I don't really not quite sure what that was. So we're pretty close to having a mushroom session here.
Julia, how did you get? Do you make beer too?
I actually did start as a home brewer.
I need to ask that.
Yeah, we estimate at the Brewers Association there's probably at least 500,000 home brewers in the United States.
Well, listen, we're moving right along here. We're pouring the next beer, and let me fill in for Colin here because he's doing the pouring, and he's even cleaning out the glasses. What a guy! And what are we doing now? We're doing Hefeweizen or North Star Amber?
Hefeweizen.
Okay. Yes. So we're staying in the lighter category of beers?
We are. And mine is pretty standard, though I think it stands out a little bit, which is why this is the beer that I've entered into the Great American Beer Festival this year.
Oh, it's sparkling.
Yeah, thank you. It's...
fabulous.
To me, it's about the most fun and unique style of beer out there.
I've never had anything that tasted like this ever.
Those flavors are very unique. The yeast is basically the star in this beer. It's about 50% wheat, so that kind of changes the flavor profile as well. Gives you a lot of proteins and stuff for the yeast to work off. But the star here is really the yeast. And it creates just these wonderful, unique flavors, banana, clove. Sometimes people think it tastes like bubble gum. And they're just very unique, fun flavors. And
how did you ever dream this up, and why didn't anybody ever think of it before
Hefeweizen's been around. Hefeweizen is a traditional European summer beer.
This is unique, this one.
And I must confess, until I met this one, I never liked it.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Now, does this also have hops in it?
Yes, all beer has hops, especially German beers.
But less than in some beers, certainly.
Very little. Like I said, the yeast is the guy here. Like, you really want the yeast character and flavors to dominate. And so the hop profile is very subtle. And I think this beer is pretty much great with anything.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Now, you think you're going to win?
I sure hope so.
I mean, the organizer of the Great American Beer Festival is online here.
It's tough competition out there, too, I'll tell you.
Well, I hope you're taking a hint that this guy gets a good start for trucking all the way into the studio for you. I think you should get a little bit of help, don't you think so, Julia?
Yeah, absolutely, especially since we contacted him on, what, Monday, Colin?
That's right.
Well, he only had to drive about... If he tells you it took him hours to get here... It's only about 6 miles away.
Well, that's beautiful. Great for geography. And you know what? You all are in very excellent beer country.
Oh, yes.
Out there,
yes, we know that.
In the land of...
Yeah, we were talking before we came on the air about Tom Pastorius, who makes Penn Pilsner and a number of other brews. He was on the program in the very early days of the program, and he's a total nut about making beer the German way.
Excellent.
So food pairings, Colin?
Well, like I said, it's kind of an oddball. It's got its own flavor profiles going on. I, again, would generally pair this with potentially a spicy dish, just because of the unique flavors. Kind of
gone with your veal burgers,
something to play off of.
Oh, there you go. Well, Anne's suggesting let's not be made veal burgers, which has a secret ingredient called Chinese five spice. Just a little bit.
Yeah.
And it would pick up on that extremely well.
It would be very good.
Good with Thai food?
Yeah, I think so. Generally also very hoppy beers tend to play well with spicy foods.
Mm-hmm.
But just because of all the extra unique flavors, that it's basically I feel like Hefeweizen can kind of mold into whatever you're eating and kind of play off of any kind of flavor. Generally, I probably wouldn't go with a red meat with this beer because it's just not hearty.
Right.
It doesn't have that depth, but I feel like it's a strong beer for for going in many different directions as far as food goes.
Now, what percentage of alcohol is in this?
It's pretty light. It's about 5.2. The beer we tasted before is like about 7.5.
Maybe
so.
That's why I feel a little goofy.
it's like she sat back and drank pints of it, listeners. She only got a thimbleful and she gave half of that back. But so what do you think, Julia? Hefeweizen, you've come across Hefeweizen lots of times.
Yeah, and traditionally Hefeweizens do so well with seafood, sushi. You know, cheeses would be great with some goat cheese.
Yeah, goat cheese.
You know, herbed or boursin. So, and then maybe some strawberry shortcake for dessert.
There you go. So this is another tricky beer that would span all parts of the menu.
I think so.
Yeah,
and it can link into a lot of flavors that are going on. That's one of the things with beer that we're excited about in telling and sharing with people is that a lot of the flavors in malt and wheat when you ferment it will link into the flavors in the food. And what wine does so well is contrast food, where beer on the opposite end can really complement it and link into a lot of those flavors.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. I never thought about that.
It's like
when you have come up with some fabulous beer like this, now, what quantity? You say every single one of Rock Bottom produces its own beers, so that no matter how many restaurants, these beers would be unique.
Yeah, it should be a unique experience in any Rock Bottom that you go to across the country. And I think that's one of the things that we as brewers in the company really thrive on and really enjoy, is that they do care enough to respect our opinion and just kind of give us the qualifications we need to succeed at our job, and then cut us loose and get as creative as we can be and really try to turn out some unique things.
Well, now, how much of this would you make?
I generally do. Our unit of measurement is called a barrel. I'm sure you've heard the term.
I've heard of a barrel, yeah.
It's 31 gallons, basically. And I have a 22-barrel system. So I do about 680 gallons per batch.
And then what happens?
Then I hope people like it and they drink it. And then I replace it with the next beer.
Do you make something new every day?
I do carry five staple brands that they do not change. I may tweak the recipes from time to time if I feel like it's become stagnant or something like that, you know, or people are just getting bored of the same thing. So I may tweak a recipe a little bit, but you want to kind of stay in the same mold. And then what we try to do is offer a range from a very light American-style lager and then go all the way to the opposite end of the spectrum with the very dark beers, the stouts and the porters, and try to cover all bases in between. And then we keep a couple extra taps for rotating seasonals, and that's where we really get creative and start coming up with stuff.
Well, that sounds like a good point. I wish to take a break. So let's do that.
Can you hang around? We're going to take a break.
I sure will.
Okay. Take a break.
The internet is crucial to your business. Everybody knows this, but did you know Nidhogg is the company you should call for internet service? Nidhogg, personal web page hosting for less. Business web page hosting, Nidhogg offers both Unix and NT server support. Nidhogg is the company you should call for dedicated internet access. Nidhogg offers DSL for high speed, low cost, always on access. DSL is great. It means no more dial-up. Oh, by the way, do you remember that thing called the telephone? Do you remember when people used phone lines to access the internet? Oh, I'm sorry, you still use dial-up? Well, Nidhogg does that too. Local access telephone numbers. Okay, I don't understand it all either, but I do know that I need it, and I know where to get it. Nidhogg, Nidhogg.com, 412-661-5917. That's 661-5917, or log on, Nidhogg.com. Internet the Nidhogg way.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Don't forget to check out our website, onthemenuradio.com. And we are conducting in the studio, believe it or not, a beer tasting. We have on the phone Julia Hertz, who is the leader of a division. You have to explain the whole thing, Julia, to us. So the Brewers Association, which is a obviously a trade organization, and we also have Colin Peterson, who is here in the studio letting us sample these beers that are remarkable that he himself has made.
He's actually Peter Mann. He must be related to Jay
Peterman,
the catalog guy. You said Peterson, but that's okay.
Not
a problem. Listen, let's get the most important thing
Jay Peterman.
For everybody so that you all can do the same thing.
If you wouldn't give me so much
how do people find out about Rock Bottom and get to Rock Bottom?
Well, we're located on the waterfront down in Homestead, what used to be the Homestead Mills down on the river on the Mon. And it's basically right across the Homestead Grays Bridge and down into the shopping center there on the waterfront, right across from Dave & Buster's.
Now, is there a website?
Yeah, it's rockbottom.com, and you can find our location through the main website.
So rockbottom.com takes you to all the Rock Bottom locations across the country?
Correct.
And you can find the one closest to you?
Very much so.
All right. Well, I know our son used to love it, and I'm sure you're packed on summer evenings. You're having a good time.
I hope so, yeah. I think we do pretty well down there, and I hope it's the beer people come for.
So we're on to beer number three.
Well, the last beer that we're going to taste here is my North Star Amber. This is a staple beer that I keep on year-round, and it's a pretty traditional amber ale. It's not very hoppy. It's what I like to call a bridge beer. It kind of bridges the gap between very malty beers when you start to get into the darker stuff with like brown ales, English style brown ales, and when you're moving away from the very hoppy beers that are most popular on the West Coast, as Julia, I'm sure, could tell you. Between.
What was the place we went to where it was really high alcohol content? Was it Rogue?
Oh, yes. We went to the Rogue Brewer, and we had some of their malt wine, which is up in the 18% alcohol range. You have to be careful with that.
The beers nowadays, some of the craft brewers are really pushing the envelope for alcohol level, and they're known as extreme beers. And just to jump in on a good little tidbit on Rogue, they're getting exported to countries like China now.
Wow.
And so American brewers are being looked at as some of the best in the world, and the beer, there's a demand for it overseas, which is kind of cool.
Oh, they make a great beer. We actually were at the brewery restaurant, and so we sampled several kinds.
The food wasn't so good.
With food, yeah, the food. I guess nobody got around to food pairings just yet. So in the notes that Colin sent me before the program, he said one of the reasons that this beer is so popular is also because of mainstream beer. I mean, Yuengling pretends it's a craft beer, but it's really not.
Not really, not so much. But in this region, especially all through Pennsylvania, you know, it is king of beers. Budweiser's got nothing on Yuengling here. And through as a result of that, you know, this is my second most popular beer in my store. And I don't mind that idea. I just don't like it when my servers say, oh, it tastes like Yuengling.
But yeah, I guess you have to get, at least they don't say it tastes like Budweiser.
Yep.
This would be really bad. So we would match this up, Colin, with?
I think this is where you would go in with your steaks and your meats and stuff like this. The malt gives you kind of that depth of body, and this is where we used in the caramel malts is what kind of gives it the color and a little bit of that depth. And I don't want to call it a sweetness, but it's not. But what it is residual sugars that give you this body, and the body is what I think plays well with the red meats.
Huh. There you go. This would be a good sausage beer too. Right?
Absolutely,
absolutely fabulous beer with sausage.
What do you think of Guinness?
I think that it's one of the best beers in the world.
Do you really?
I actually prefer Murphy's, but what Guinness has done to bring stout to the mainstream has really opened people's eyes to that beer doesn't just have to be over-carbonated, straw yellow, and as flavorless as possible.
Yeah.
My favorite, I have to say, in the stout department is Samuel Smith's Imperial Stout.
It's a good one.
but there you go. Well, it's made. It's also made in my home county of Yorkshire, not too far away from where I was born. So that probably there's some prejudice there. It's good to know that this beer is made not just in Pennsylvania; it's made in Homestead.
It is,
and it's made with the wonderful water coming from the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority.
Absolutely,
water is important to making beer, and it's
Pittsburgh
good.
Actually has very good brewing water, just naturally. I actually do not treat my brewing water at all, except for depending on the beer style that I'm making. If I need to actually get my pH a little bit lower than normal, I will maybe adjust it a little bit lower. But I also do that by using a soured malt, which is in the German tradition of staying with four natural ingredients: water, hops, malt, and yeast. So we use a soured malt to bring that pH down.
Okay, Julia. So this is a story across the country. Colin, there are how many Colins out there?
There, you know, in the late 70s, there was only 42 breweries in the U.S., for example. And today, of the 1,440 breweries, just under 1,400 of those are craft brewers. Now, a craft brewer is considered a smaller producing, independently owned, traditionally based, meaning mostly ferments malt, for what they do. So those small, independent, and traditional brewers like Colin and Rock Bottom are out there, almost 1,400 of them.
Now, tell us about the activities of, I think you have two associations that you're associated with. Tell us a little bit about how you help in this process.
Yeah, I mean, the Brewers Association is an organization that's a non-profit trade association. We're educational-based, and we're out there talking about beer and craft beer all day long, and that's what we do. There's different divisions of the organization, and one of them is events, and we put on the Great American Beer Festival. And this year in Denver, Colorado, will be the 26th year for that. The other divisions within the organization are all doing different things, but focused on the part of helping the small American craft brewer. And also, too, it's linked into home brewing. So we have a division called the American Homebrewers Association.
You know, that's growing, too, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, it is. We have 12,000 members, give or take, and we publish the magazine Zymergy, which has been around forever.
Yeah.
And our president, Charlie Papazian, who really is kind of the father of home brewing, and has influenced so many people. Maybe even Colin, you know, got a copy of his book when he was starting out. And he's really helped do it all, and he's still on board here working every day to talk about good craft beer.
Now, there are a couple of icons of the craft beer business. Fritz Maytag, I guess, is one.
Absolutely. And then, Anchor Brewing Company of Fritz Maytag. They're one of the first. They're one of the first.
And then the other guy is the guy from Red Hook in Seattle?
Yes, Paul Shipman.
Okay, I couldn't remember his name.
Mm-hmm.
So they're two of the real outstanding figures of this movement, but it's become a much bigger movement even than it was when they started. I don't know that they would have even thought it would have gotten this far.
No, probably not. But what kind of is going on, at least today, to get everybody understanding, is we're all, as appreciators and consumers, more open-minded into what we try. If you look at all the things that we eat nowadays, from chocolates to coffee to ice cream to beer. I mean, we want flavor and diversity in what we're given choice to buy. And craft beer, is around at the right time with that, because brewers like Colin, they want to push the envelope and be out there giving choices with people trying different things at different meals instead of drinking the same beer every day, day after day.
But, you know, I can't get past this concern. You get this great beer, and it goes away. I mean, do people also bottle it?
Explain the question a little bit.
I know that Fritz Maytag's gets bottled, but would somebody like Collins beers get bottled?
Got it. Well, you know, the majority of those 1,400 brewers that I mentioned that are craft brewers, most of them are brew pubs. And so that your local beer is what is mostly being consumed in a way. And so beer from the backyard brewery or the down-the-street brewery, that's being consumed fresh in pint glasses from the tap and often not bottled at all, or if it's carried out, it's packaged in a growler and it's meant to be drinking a day or two later. And that's a really neat thing because it keeps our brewers connected with their backyards and their communities. And I call craft brewers kind of the local Chautauqua of their community.
Oh, cute.
Because they're really supporting their marketplace by donating time and beer and dollars to charities, and people meet there and talk about the business of the day, and it's really a common thing to have Brewpub be involved in town business nowadays. And then another neat statistic is, and this you really can't say that's happening in the wine industry in the U.S., which is also flourishing, the average American lives within 10 miles of a brewery. And if you think about that, that means that the average American has a chance to go meet their local brewer, get the story behind the brand being made in their backyard, and then, you know, come on board as a fan and an advocate.
Oh, that's really, it's a wonderful. And how many people go to this Great American Beer event?
Ooh la la. I call it a national holiday, practically. It is the granddaddy of all festivals for ticketed beer festivals. And the event last year had 41,000 plus people.
Holy Moses.
Yeah, and we sell out. Last year, three of the four sessions sold out. So there's four different tasting sessions. If anyone is interested in information, it's October 11th through the 13th in Denver, Colorado. And GreatAmericanBeerFestival.com is the website. And this is the place where, you know, over 400 American brewers go to serve their beer. Over 1,700 beers will be served. And the judging of these beers is also happening behind the scenes. So it's not just a public tasting session. It's the awards ceremony that establishes the number one main best example of a commercial style in the U.S. And so if you win a gold medal from the Great American Beer Festival, nobody else won a gold medal compared to wine competitions where golds are given if you reach a certain point level. When you get a beer medal from the Great American Beer Festival, you made the best beer in the world for that style that you got judged in.
Wow. Julie, this has been a fascinating session for us. We're about a half a minute before we close the segment. Is there any more information that we should get out here?
Yeah, I mean, anything from beer and food to people wanting to know about beer styles and what's going on, beertown.org is the association, Brewers Association's website. And just support, you know, your local backyard brewery. Feels good, tastes better, is what I like to say.
I think we do that here. Oh, Julia, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful experience. And keep in touch.
Absolutely. Thanks for being open-minded to the show.
Oh, love it.
And best to all of you.
Absolutely love it. Thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Now, Colin, we need to take a break.
The flagship station of the Lifestyle Talk Radio Network. This is 1550 WLFP. Pittsburgh.
Hi, friends. I'm Phil Marcus, the host of Real Estate 101, heard every Saturday here on The Edge, AM 1550. If you've been thinking about selling your house or buying a house, I'd like to speak with you. Choosing the right agent is one of the first and most important steps in the process of buying or selling real estate. It's critical that you choose an agent who has the knowledge and experience to not only find that perfect new home for you, but to also be able to guide you step by step through the often complicated real estate process. If you don't already have a realtor, may I offer my services? I've been a real estate agent in Pittsburgh for almost 30 years. I'm a life member of the Realtors Association, and I'm proud to say that I've earned both the GRI and the coveted CRS professional designations. Won't you call me at RE/MAX Heritage? The phone number is 412-241-4200, extension 154, or my email address is phil@philmarcus.com. That's 412-241-4200, extension 154, or phil@philmarcus.com. Let's talk.
Welcome back to On the Menu. We're going to have a different change of course at this point. We, back in July, in fact, it was Bastille Day, we went to Jameson's Lamb Farm near Latrobe, and we had a picnic to raise a fundraiser for the Jean-Louis Paladin Foundation, and we did a bunch of interviews at that time, which we haven't run yet. So let's start off by listening to John Jamison. Explain what the Jean-Louis Paladin Foundation is all about. John Jamison, my dear friend, and I mean, I can't even say how many people admire you, your business, and what you do for charity. And you and Suki, your wife and partner, have just done it again for the Jean-Louis Paladin Foundation with this wonderful event at your farm, Jamison Farm. How did you think it went?
I thought it was great. We had about 50 people that paid to come, and a lot of workers, a lot of chefs from all over the country, really. But what I think we're trying to do here is certainly keep the legacy of Jean-Louis going, which was basically working with small producers to find the best products for the farm. And the foundation, as you know, we send interns out in the field to do that. The great thing about this event, and what I think we're really trying to do, is bring a chef like Billy Telepan, who was the best new chef under the Zagat guide for 2007, into this neighborhood, cook for everybody, show off what he does, but at the same time, instead of being a formal event, have him sit down with his six-year-old daughter, talk to everybody. She's running around having a great time. Everybody's talking about the great wines we have. And so then in 6 months, when somebody has been here and he goes to New York and wants to get a table at Telepan and it takes 3 weeks to get it, maybe that won't happen. Maybe it's a better way. And we start working with the chefs so that we're really trying to bring the celebrity chef thing from the Food Channel back to a one-on-one situation. And I think that's what we're trying to do.
I was just astonished at how good the food was here. Who comes to this thing?
Well, so far what we've had is a lot of local people here in Westmoreland County that supported us, which was very nice, and it was great because these people know what we have done, and that really made me feel very good because they don't really buy from us that much, but on the other hand, they have nice wine cellars, they go to fancy restaurants in New York and Las Vegas, and they see our name on the menu, but maybe they don't buy from us or come to the farm or whatever. So this really gave them a chance to see what we really do. And they were very, very supportive, and it was very nice.
I thought it was a really wonderful event. Everybody here loved the food, but they were also very, very interested in supporting the Scholarship Foundation.
Well, that's right. And I think it shows an understanding of what Jean-Louis was trying to do. Jean-Louis was trying to get better food in restaurants. And so when he couldn't get the French food that he wanted in the restaurants, one of the big battles we have in the foundation is he was not necessarily interested in French food. He was interested in finding American food that was as good, if not better, than French food. So for instance, the foie gras that we had tonight was from Hudson Valley Foie Gras, and he really started Michael Ganoran business. Ariane Dauguin sends stuff from D'Artagnan. And she, of course, is from the same area of France that he was from, Gascogne, and he was a friend of her father's, who's a famous chef in Gascogne. So anyway, it was just showing what we were trying to do and showing that really the difference is on the plate.
I cannot recount. Surely I've just been in a really major restaurant, but for an event like this, I cannot believe that the food was this quality. I mean, you could have died for this. Chris Jackson did chicken wings that he worked on with various processes for 3 days to get them to taste that way. This foie gras was beyond description. And then there was your lamb, which is, we're talking Jamison Farm lamb. It was so extraordinary. And Bill Telepan cooked it sous vide for, 24 hours. And then, it was just, everything was just so absolutely gorgeous. And plus these wines. You're going to have this next year?
Yes, Yes, yeah, we are, definitely. And we hope we get more people to come, but yes, we will have more people. You know, we'll certainly do the event next year. And the food was incredible, and you're right about people were taking time to do special things, which was really neat. Jimmy Sneed, who was Jean-Louis' sous chef, and his partner at the Frog and the Redneck, which probably is politically incorrect to say, but anyway, they had, and Jimmy and I went to Walmart today and got a turkey cooker and peanut oil, and he's the king of soft shell crabs. He was known for soft shell crabs when he cooked in Virginia before he even worked with Jean-Louis. So he was very excited about what he was doing. He did a hanger steak of lamb with wild mushrooms, which I thought was wonderful. And you described Chris's dish. And then what Chris did, which was really cool, with, I don't know if you caught this, but with leftover foie gras, he put that on the lamb. I mean, it rocked.
I can't wait till next year.
I don't know what broke. It was a while ago. Oh, dear, weren't we having a good time? Well, now, at this event, we had guest chefs, which John talked about a bit, and we're going to now listen to the interviews with some of them. The first one up is Chris Jackson, who's the executive chef of Six Pen Kitchen in Pittsburgh.
Chris Jackson, of course, we've come kind of a roundabout way to interview you since you were in Pittsburgh and we're now in Latrobe at the Jean-Louis Belladin Foundation event. You are executive chef of Six Pen Kitchen, and you've created such a stir since you came to Pittsburgh. Hello.
How are you doing? And it has been a great, great time ever since I've been in Pittsburgh, and it's been amazing. A tough little transition at first, wondering what was going to happen, but I think that this transition and the stir and everything that's going on has been wonderful.
Well, I mean, you were born in Hawaii, you've lived all over the place, you've worked every place, you've associated with so many different chefs. I guess before you came to Pittsburgh, you were at, where in Philadelphia?
That was at Jake's Restaurant.
Four star, right?
Four star American restaurant, right off on Main Street in Manayunk. Bruce Cooper has been doing it for about 18 years now and started taking chefs on. So I was a chef de cuisine, and we actually went through one of the star ratings when I was there. So I was able to, you know, keep up the four stars while I was there. So it was quite impressive. It was a great endeavor.
Listeners, this man is amazing. I mean, that's the only thing I can say about somebody who does. When I say in-house, I mean everything. From making his own mustard, mayonnaise, tell me, everything. Maraschino cherries.
From the bar program to curing our own olives, maraschino cherries. Like you said, mayonnaise, mustard, our mozzarella. We get the honey locally from Pennsylvania, make the pizza doughs every day. The rotisserie, the smoker, our own bacon. If we can get it. In-house, we're gonna do it in-house. And right now, we are at about 75% of our menu being completely from Pennsylvania, all local, sustainable, you know, grass-fed, you know, lamb and pork and venison, sustainable fish from the Monterey Bay Fish Aquarium website to local vegetables, Hmong Dynasty. I mean, you name it. It's on our menu. So, and I'm close to becoming all our proteins. I'm working with a cattle farmer here in Pennsylvania to have organic Pennsylvania grass-fed beef on our menu. So when we do, we will have all our proteins from Pennsylvania.
I mean, I'm just in awe because I don't really understand what motivates you. You don't have to do all that.
Definitely don't have to do that. This is something that takes a little bit of extra time every day, every week on my day off. I talk to farmers. I go to farms. I visit every farm before I will use their product and inspect their facilities, walk around, meet the farmer, you know, just get that relationship. So I call Denise at Wilden, ask her when the hogs are going in and, you know, what's going on with the slaughter, when's this going to happen. We're at John and Suki's house right now, you know, amazing couple, amazing lamb. And it's going past that, you know, bridging that gap from just ordering food, this frozen food product, whatever, not really knowing where your food comes from. I think the big turnaround was the French Laundry cookbook when he actually talks about bringing in the rabbits to teach the line cooks actually where your food comes from. And, you know, having the rabbits come in and actually have them go through the slaughter process, which is a little extreme. I wouldn't make my line cooks go through that. But it gives you a better sense of where your product comes from. It gives you just a better understanding. You take better care of that product. And, you know, you follow it all the way through the process. And then when you give it to your customer, I mean, there's no better, you know, great sense in the world than, you know, being able to give them something that you got locally and that you really worked on. And, you know, they can enjoy that great product.
So why did you say yes to coming and cooking at the Jean-Louis Paladin Foundation event?
I don't even think it was a question. When I worked in Richmond, Virginia, I worked right down the street from Jean-Louis and Jimmy Sneed at the Frog and the Redneck. I took my mother there for Mother's Day. I respect him. You know, him along with Marco Pierre White are two of the youngest chefs to ever win, you know, the Michelin stars, and to gain that kind of accreditation and then come to D.C., have the Watergate, and really, you know, kind of take food to that next level where he really does understand it, and he treats food properly, and he takes the time and he just makes sure that the customers, the guests, his cooks all understand where the food's coming from, and, you know, just, you know, bringing it to the plate and to the guests. I respect the man. I respect his career, and I wouldn't even have thought twice about it.
Well, you're certainly amazing, we just recently toured your rooftop garden. Give us details. Sixpen Kitchen is part of Eaton Park. It's located in the Cultural District in downtown Pittsburgh, and you're growing all the stuff on your roof.
Yeah, that was one of the greatest things this year, was converting the second part of our roof. We have a rooftop deck, which you toured, which was it's wonderful. But on the other side, right now, I'm actually almost at tomato season. I went up to the other day. We've been pulling nasturtiums, edible flowers, wonderful herbs, and lemon balm. We've had baby black zucchini, whole blossoms that we've been using. The tomatoes are almost there. I have cecum cucumber vines. And now we actually just installed 2 weeks ago plots for all of our organic lettuces that we're going to be growing up there with an edible flower garden. So right now we have about 90 different plots. We call it urban gardening. We're on the roof in buckets, but we do it all organic. We get the seeds from southwestern Pennsylvania, again, keeping in line with the local community, and it's going great. We had Press and Table Magazine.
Well, you were... Actually, to tell you the truth, Chris, you wear me out. I mean, you have so much energy. But anyhow, everybody should come and try out. I've never met anybody so dedicated to doing everything from scratch. Thank you for talking to us.
It's been a pleasure meeting both of you, and I love your show, and I can't wait to have you back down at the restaurant.
We'll take a break now.
Data security and speed can be what puts your business ahead of your competition. But cost is important too. You might be paying every month for bandwidth you don't use. Let's talk about your company's disaster recovery system. Is it as effective and secure as it could be? What are you paying for your T1 line? I'll bet we can offer you a better deal. We're ASP Station, a premier independent server co-location facility and high-speed internet access provider. Virtually unlimited bandwidth, co-location for your backup servers, off-site system backup, and secure access to your equipment 24/7. Check us out on the web at aspstation.net or call us at 412-661-6001. Easy number to remember, 412-661-6001. ASP Station, 412-661-6001.
You know how sometimes you hear people say, I wonder if I have the right investments. I wonder if I can retire early. I'm not sure how much money I will need to invest today to retire comfortably. How do I know what I should do to be able to help my children pay for college? What do I need to know to start a business or buy a house? We are the people who can help you find the answers to those questions. I'm Mary Grace Musenegi, the senior partner of the Musenegi Financial Group. We're a financial consulting firm that helps people make wise decisions with their money. We have a unique second opinion program that allows us to review your financial plans and investments with you without you changing advisors, companies, or products. So for a free consultation, please give us a call at 412-833-2888 or email me personally at mfgplanners, Mary Grace Musenagi at mfgplanners.com. Again, email me at marygrace@mfgplanners.com.
Now, one of the other chefs, I better say where you are. You're listening on the Menu Radio, and this is Ann Haig. Peter and the beer guys are gone, so I'm here on my own. And we're going to listen to a chef that was Chris Jackson mentioned in the last interview, Jimmy Sneed, who's actually a legend among chefs. He's a wonderful, wonderful man and a divine chef restaurateur. So let's listen to what Jimmy has to say.
On the menu is Jamison Farm in Latrobe. And we are still having the most marvelous reception in honor of the late Jean-Louis Paladin and to benefit his foundation. We're talking to somebody who has a very long history with Jean-Louis. We're talking to Jimmy Sneed, and you will think of him as the frog and the redneck, but you're going to bring us up today. First of all, your connection to Jean-Louis.
Oh, I started working for Jean-Louis in June of 1981. I had heard, I had gone to the French embassy looking for a job cooking, thinking that's where all the great French chefs would be, and there was one 26-year-old kid working there, and he says, if you want to learn to cook from the best, go see Jean-Louis Paladin at the Watergate. And I said, great, who's he? He said, oh my God, he's the greatest chef in America, maybe the world. So I went over to the Watergate and I introduced myself. I said, are you Jean-Louis? He says, yes, what do you want? I said, well, I hear you're the greatest chef in the world. He says, that true? What do you want? And I said, well, I'd like to learn from you. I'd like to cook for you. And he basically said he had an opening for 6 weeks and then he was closing for August. And in September, he had a French cook coming over. So he only needed me for 6 weeks. So I took the job, and on July 31st, he casually said, if you want to come back in September, you come back. So I came back, and I ended up spending 5.5 miserable years with this guy.
You're a delight. And this restaurant that you had is defunct, right? Tell us about it. I mean, everybody knows about this restaurant.
Well, it was called The Frog and the Redneck, and The Frog was a tribute to Jean-Louis because he certainly made me a chef. Without him, I probably wouldn't have stayed in cooking. And it came from the name came from a shouting match one night in the kitchen. It was not unusual for him to scream at me a lot. What was unusual is that this one night I kind of snapped, and I finally told him to shut up, you stupid frog. And suddenly the whole kitchen stopped, and I think the dish machine stopped, and the air conditioning unit shut off. And he turned to me and he said, what did you call me? And I said, nothing, chef. He says, did you call me a stupid frog? And I said, yes, chef. He said, well, then you must be a redneck. And I thought, ooh, that hurt. And but that there was born the name of a restaurant.
Now, it closed. When did it close?
Closed in March of 01.
And then where did you go?
Well, at that point, I thought maybe I wanted to just get into some consulting, and I wanted to be near my mother, who was in Charleston, South Carolina. So I moved down there, and I stumbled into a restaurant that was as beautiful a restaurant as I've ever seen, but was suffering badly. It had been open about a year and a half and was just spinning out of control. And the owner asked me if I could help him turn the restaurant around. So I took the challenge. And 8 months later, a wine enthusiast called us one of the best restaurants in America. And then some folks from Las Vegas approached me and asked me if I would move to Vegas. And I said, no, thank you. And the owner of the restaurant got wind of it and said, oh, you'll go to Vegas. Everybody ends up leaving me, and you will too. So he shut the restaurant down. And I thought, oh, well, you know, I'm going to Vegas.
Well, did you say what the name of the restaurant was?
I did not.
Thank you. Okay, so fast forward here. You moved on, but you now have this gorgeous granddaughter that you're enthralled with, and so you are now moving back to Richmond.
Right. Vegas wasn't my world. It's a world of unions and corporate structure, and that's certainly not me. And we had a disagreement somewhat over the style of restaurant that I was hired to run. And then my daughter had a daughter, and we decided that we wanted to watch our granddaughter grow up, so we moved back to Richmond.
And I'm going to jump ahead. You told me you're opening a Jamaican restaurant?
Right. My best friend is a Jamaican woman in Richmond who has had a place for 13 years, a carryout that just has a line out the door all day, every day. And she's always wanted to do a sit-down restaurant, so we're going in partners. It's going to be called Karina's Jamaican Grill. And it's going to have an authentic Jamaican menu, but it's also going to have burgers, salads, pizzas, because we want to appeal to everybody. And trust me, when you go in there and order a pizza, but you try somebody else's curry chicken, the next time you come back, you're going to eat Jamaican food.
Now, listeners, I must tell you that this man for this special event tonight cooked crab. And he was actually being very mean to me by not letting me have all I wanted, but I did end up getting the best crab knuckles, I think, and crab nuggets and crab, soft-shell crab. Tell us about that.
Okay, so when I left Washington, D.C., I went to a waterman's town in Virginia and took over a restaurant, and the waterman used our dock to unload their crabs, so I needed to make that my specialty. And they taught me this dish where if you've got crabs that are a little tough, you trim the legs, you take the top skin off, and you fry the nuggets, the two nuggets of meat, in a tempura batter, very hot. And they're just awesome.
They certainly were. And I thank you. I look forward to your Jamaican restaurant. Thank you, Jimmy.
All right. Thank you very much.
Oh, boy. Food memories. Oh, I just thought that the food was just so incredibly amazing. And listeners, if they do another one of these events next July, we'll be sure to give you plenty of notice. Now we have a fourth visiting chef for the event. One I'm going to hang on to the next program because we don't have time, Evan Danko, but I have him on another track. But we'll jump into Bill Telepan, whose restaurant Telepan's in New York is one of our most favorite places, and he has to be one of the most decent, wonderful guys in the world. We had a great deal of fun having him at this event.
Bill Telepan, we've interviewed you before, and the sound quality was so awful, and you were so full of information and such a wonderful chef and restaurateur. I'm pleased to have the opportunity at the Jean-Louis Paladin Foundation event to talk to you again. I actually love you.
Thank you very much. I love you guys too. So, and I'm glad to be here. So,
I asked you before. I mean, you've come from New York, and why was it so important for you to be at this event?
Well, there are many reasons why. I think there's Jean-Louis Paladin, of course, who we were talking to about before, and how he was such a great sourcer of ingredients, and how some of the people that I buy from and many other chefs who buy from today, he was the one who discovered these people and helped procure them and develop them and gave them the ability to sort of grow themselves and be able to produce for people like me now, 20-30 years later. So yeah, very. And then also there's John and Suki Jameson, who are for the last 20-plus years have been friends of mine, and who their daughters worked at my restaurant. You know, their son was a waiter at Gotham when I was there. So I've known them very well for such a long time. So when they asked me to do this, I, you know, of course said yes. So. And then there's my dad, who grew up about 40 minutes from here. So we're going to go visit his hometown. So.
Well, you're home. You're really home in a way.
Where the original telepans come from. So we're all from Western Pennsylvania.
Now, see, I never knew that in our first interview, which you couldn't understand anyhow.
And I have to say that I had to explain, sadly, to Bill and his father that Rolling Rock is now brewed in Newark, New Jersey, and everybody around here doesn't like it anymore.
Oh,
right. We don't like it anymore.
Oh, we're having a good time, listeners. Bill, your restaurant is really wonderful. Upper West Side. Your focus is on ingredients.
Yes, my focus on ingredients and seasonality and just trying to get the best ingredient. I mean, tonight's we were talking about like the potatoes, right? And he said the potatoes are really good. The potatoes, so we used the potatoes from Chef's Gardens, which are awesome, and the five-star butter and some herbs and salt, and then all I had to do was cook them. Right. So and I just grilled, put them on the grill. It wrapped them in foil with a little water, the butter, the thing, the salt, and put them on the grill, and you know, just watch them.
But hey, let's talk about this lamb shoulder roast that you sous vide.
Yeah, well, it's you know the slow roasted lamb shoulder, and then what we were we sous vide it and cooked it for 24 hours, so it comes out really tender. All the fibers break down to make it a really soft lamb, and then grilling it at the last minute just brings out, you know, chars it, brings out that good grilling flavor, and you know, and the lamb itself is just awesome.
What did you think about the food here? I mean, you're a chef. The food at this event was like I couldn't stop eating. I was always amazed.
The great thing about an event like this is that you know you have a grill. You have a couple chefs in the kitchen. You have some great ingredients, and it's for a great cause, and there's a lot of love, and there's just all this camaraderie, and there's just a lot of fun, and there's beer, there's wine, there's kids running around making cupcakes. I mean, it's just a fun event to be. So, I mean, there's no pressure. I mean, it's just really a wonderful cause, a really wonderful, and there's all these wonderful people around here, you know, and so it just makes it, you know, much easier to cook. You know, it's so much easier to cook this way.
and eat, I might add. Website.
www.telepan-ny.com.
That's TELEPAN, listeners. And I'm really probably a big fan.
72 West 69th Street in the Upper West Side of Manhattan.
And go, listeners, go.
Well, we sure did have a good time. I mean, one little comment I have to say is there's a good reason why people don't use the lamb skirt steak very much because it took probably hours to trim it up because it's not very big. Anyhow, get all excited about going someplace where all these wonderful chefs come to cook, and I think the event's going to be actually even bigger and better next year. I'm already drooling. I dream of the soft-shell crabs. Thank you, Jimmy. And, of course, the Jamison Lamb. And thanks to Suki and John for all their good work, and particularly for the Jean-Louis Paladin Foundation. Well, listeners, I think that just about does it for us today. We'll be back same time next week. And until then, have a good eating and traveling time, and bye-bye.
Jazzin' Around with David J. is next on The Edge, AM 1550.